to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Isn't it extraordinary, Ellen, that we are now absolutely on the cusp of this paradigm shift? Too many ordinary people all across the political spectrum now, they say, where's my bailout? You know, people absolutely see what's going on. And naturally, this has created all of the anger about the particular kind of globalization that really Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan cooked up, which is all about GDP growth, which we know was not counting all those external social and environmental costs and has been sort of driving us over the cliff. And basically, it was just about privatization, deregulation, and financialization. We now know how many people that left behind. And sooner or later, they were going to rise up. You just can't impose this kind of cost on the rest of the population. They're not going to take it.
That's our guest today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, author, futurist, and noted global economist Hazel Henderson, describing the reality that animates the vibrant and troubled global political and economic scene, including here in the U.S., of course. Hello, and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute, welcoming you to another look at the dynamics that are driving our world as it tries to keep systems together to provide a viable future. We'll also hear how local economies are being affected by discriminatory bank practices and how the politics of local self-interest and control are shifting the dominant paradigm of top-down control by enabling citizens to be the real agents for change. And we'll talk with one such citizen who's taken to the streets of Philadelphia to stake a claim against top-down politics. Never a dull moment. Let's check in with Ellen.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Hazel Henderson, who is president of Ethical Markets Media, publisher of the Green Transition Scoreboard, the author of 9 books, including Building a Win-Win World, and the co-producer of the Ethical Markets TV special, The Money Fix, among other notable achievements. We are also honored to have her on the advisory board of the Public Banking Institute. It's great to be speaking with you again, Hazel.
Oh, well, thanks for setting this up, Ellen. It's always good to talk to you, and you know I love the Public Banking Institute. You're doing great work.
Oh, thank you, and you're doing great work, too, and you're so easy to talk to. I love interviewing you.
Well, I think we have a bit of a mutual admiration society going, I must say.
You just wrote, it's an excellent overview of monetary policy and where we are today, how we got to where we are, and how we could fix it. It's titled, Ben Bernanke and Milton Friedman Were Right, Helicopter Money or Qualitative Easing.
Oh, right.
So you're talking about qualitative easing, not quantitative
easing. Qualitative easing, absolutely. I mean, you know, theoretically, there's not anything much wrong with printing money. I mean, that's what governments ought to be doing when they need to. We don't need to have banks do it. But I mean, the point is that as long as it's not given to bail out past mistakes and is used to invest in the future and what we need going forward, you know, whether it's moving toward a green economy and green infrastructure or, you know, taking those student loans off the books, and why not take them on the Fed's balance sheet, you know? If they can take dud mortgages, why not release the students and think what that would do to energize the economy?
Mm-hmm. Or release some of the government debt. That's what I've written about before.
Oh, very good.
Yes.
And then I always get a lot of flack that would, if you pay off the debt with quantitative easing, you're going to create inflation. But I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
No.
And I mean, most central banks are far more worried about deflation than inflation at the moment.
Yeah,
they're trying very hard to create inflation and not succeeding.
Yeah, so it's really all about a misconception about our whole money system.
Yes.
And you've pointed out that this used to be a taboo subject about helicopter money and the possibility of the government printing the money, but all of a sudden it's hit the mainstream media, and I think it's because people are becoming more aware of where money comes from, the fact that it's not just a fixed amount of money that's out there and then you have to pay off your, you know, pay everything with it. And so you need to pull in taxes before you can.
Yes. Yeah, that was a convenient fiction for the ruling elites, right?
Yeah.
You might say.
Yeah. And it's still, the fiction still holds. I mean, you've still got Congress that believes that they have to balance the budget and therefore they have to impose austerity. And we've seen that already in Europe, that it's not working. In fact, that's one of the triggers of Brexit, the fact that everybody...
Absolutely. And, you know, the point I was making in the article is this sort of theory-induced blindness of the policymakers and the politicians, the regulators, even the business community, and it's been laid on the general public, too. You know, is this kind of cognitive capture by the old economic textbooks? And they're still taught at the business schools, you know, and that whole thing. So that's where we really do need a paradigm shift because, you know, most of what, you know, the asset managers on Wall Street learn at the Harvard Business School in their finance classes is kind of defunct. I mean, now that 195 governments have signed on to the UN Sustainable Development Goals, that completely does away with the old economic textbooks. And it means that we're moving to, you know, a multidisciplinary systems view of the whole society rather than just looking at the very narrow money circuits that are the focus of economic theory. You know, and that's, of course, what caused all these terrible external social costs and finally built up enough inequality and resentment that all over the place, whether it's Brexit or what's going on in other European countries or whether it's the Trump phenomenon here, you know, people are suddenly getting wise to it.
And you've mentioned that the reason central banks are having to do it is that we've got a dysfunctional Congress that can't agree on anything. They're polarized with poisonous partisanship, as you put it. So they're not doing it with fiscal policy, in other words, approving of spending programs. So they have to do it with monetary policy, which means the central bank does it. But then the central bank is pretty limited in their tools,
yes.
Or they say they are, although, you know, they can be real creative when they need to help the banks. So.
Of course, yes. And they really could do more. But basically, the politicians have really put the central bankers onto the hot seat. And in terms of, you know, what their conventional tools are, as we know, you know, they're now scraping the bottom of the barrel. And that's why there's all this discussion about, hey, well, you know, what about negative interest rates? Well, that doesn't work because, you know, you destroy people's savings and it's terrible for banks. And so that's not going to work. And so that's why they're down to the last resort, which is helicopter money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just wrote in my article that the ostensible excuse for negative interest rates, of course, is that because they've gotten down to zero and they still haven't stimulated the economy, the thought is that if they force you to pay interest on your deposits, that then you'll go out and spend instead, and that will encourage demand. But that actually only worked back in the 30s when you put new money out there first and then you pull it back with a stamp tax. But
it doesn't work if
you've only got a fixed amount of money, you're not going to go spend it just because it costs you more to hold it in a bank. So what actually happened in Italy was that the real reason for negative interest is that they want to go all digital to force people to keep their money in the banks so that they can then bail in this money to save the banks when they go bankrupt. But it didn't work in Italy. They've scared off the investors. So they quit investing and, you know, pulled out their equity, and the depositors pulled out their deposits. And so the banks are going bankrupt anyway. So
they, absolutely. And you've been writing about this so clearly. You know, we just love posting your articles on this because you take deeper dives into this than I do, because I'm kind of scanning the macroeconomic field and always looking for this transition, which is underlying the whole thing now of getting away from fossil fuel energy and all the climate change and the disruption it brings to the environment, and looking for investing in the renewable, clean, green, as I call it, knowledge-rich kind of economy of the future. And so, you know, I rely on you, Ellen, for a lot of the deep diving you've been doing in terms of this whole idea, you know, of moving to pure electronic money. Somebody had an article last week on Sweden, and that now Sweden is almost entirely electronic. And it could be, do you think, that they trust their government a little bit more than we do? But I mean, once government kind of becomes untrustworthy, or you have the kind of thing we had in this country where ever since Reagan, there's been this kind of war on government, you know, which is terribly worrying, really, because we do need an efficient government. And so people are naturally worried that if we go to all electronic money, we lose our freedom.
Well, and then there's this, just the practical worry of what happens when the computers go down. Are you broke? I've just been writing about blockchain, which actually does have the potential for being quite secure.
There's
still got bugs in it, and they're still working it out. But I could envision on the upside of all that, first of all, you can get rid of all the middlemen, supposedly, with blockchain. So that means
yes.
you can get rid of a lot of corruption and people taking fees that are, you know, it's hidden, that nobody realizes they were taking the fees, like we've got the scandal in California where they...
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I've done a discussion paper I'll have to send to you called FinTech, Good and Bad News for Sustainable Finance. And you're right. The good news is all of the blockchain-based ledgers. And I was just amazed to find, you know, there's about 5,000 startups now based on blockchain distributed ledgers.
Uh-huh.
So there's 5,000 blockchains now on Microsoft servers, 1.1 billion in VC deals.
Sorry, what do you mean by VC?
Venture capital.
Okay.
Investment deals. So when I'll send you this paper, Ellen, because what I'm talking about, this is the good news. The good news is that you're absolutely right that, you know, blockchain applications could really very nicely disrupt the old banking system, and it very much needs to be democratized. And the thing that I'm looking at is that the race is now on where the old bankers are now trying to compete with, own, or control these blockchain-based startups and capture their profits and turn blockchains into their version of walled gardens all over again.
They, too, though, have good uses for blockchain, that they want
yeah.
transparency. Like in with derivatives, they want to know who it is they're dealing with on the other side of their derivative, and blockchain makes it all transparent. And you know,
yes, and so, you know, I kind of looked at the history of all of this financial disruption that's going on now, which I find is really exciting because so much of it is really good. Particularly on remittances, where now these new sort of instant remittance platforms can save immigrants incredible amount of money when they're sending home money to their families and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking in our library, and I found that one of the first financial disruptors was a company called WIT Capital. And it was founded back in 1998, and it's described in the book called WallStreet.com by its founder, Andrew Klein. And they participated in 127 offerings. They raised $9 billion. And at its peak in 1999, WIT Capital was worth $2 billion. And that was the first dot-com kind of financial company. And it's kind of interesting because it was bought by another group in 2000. And Klein moved to Amsterdam. And the amazing thing is that he got in touch with me. And so I've invited him to our retreat on blockchain, on the fintech, which I hope you're still able to come to in November.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yes.
Sounds so interesting, yeah. I could envision a system where banking is pretty much all computerized. In other words, now that we know that banks just create the money they lend on their books, you're really taking out an advance against your own promise to pay. You're really turning your promise to pay into money.
Yeah.
So you could do that by computer without this sleight of hand that banks have
totally,
to do.
Totally.
Where they pretend that they're borrowing from the depositors, but they're really not. If they don't have
exactly.
the deposits, they borrow from another bank, and then they give it back the next day. They borrow overnight and give it back every day.
Yeah.
So it's just this huge sleight of hand. You could eliminate all that and just say, we're just creating the money that, you know, when you borrow, you're creating that money yourself, basically, out of the cloud.
Yeah.
And it's just like what banks do, but you're your own middleman. You don't need somebody in there.
Oh, yes. I mean, this is definitely revolutionary. And this book called Blockchain Revolution by Don Tapscott, you know, who wrote Wikonomics, is fabulous. And he is looking at all of these applications of blockchain all through so many systems, even through government. But, I mean, basically, this is what Michael Lewis was saying in Flash Boys, that it's quite true. He was just saying, well, look, we actually don't need all these intermediaries and traders on Wall Street, because all they're doing is shuffling around secondary assets with each other. They're not creating new money for new enterprises. 95% of it is just trading. And that was reinforced by Lord Adair Turner's book. He's talking about now it's time to take away from the banks of this inordinate privilege that somehow they got to create the money themselves and just bring it back into the treasury, the national treasury.
Well, and the other thing is, besides eliminating the middlemen and fraud and corruption and the expense of all that, is you could eliminate the possibility of bank runs and bank failures, and which is what causes all these periodic banking crises. We could eliminate banking crises by a different system where we acknowledge that you're just drawing the money from the central bank, basically, which has the power to create money. In other words, you're drawing against your own account and promising to pay it back. Yeah.
Isn't it extraordinary, Ellen, that we are now absolutely on the cusp of this paradigm shift?
Uh-huh,
because
it
just
is.
Too many ordinary people all across the political spectrum now, as I was noticing, you know, all of the various signs, wherever they are, they say, where's my bailout? You know, people absolutely see what's going on. And naturally, this has created all of the anger about the particular kind of globalization that really Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan cooked up, which was all about GDP growth, which we know was not counting all those external social and environmental costs and has been sort of driving us over the cliff. And basically, it was just about privatization, deregulation, and financialization. And so just we now know how many people that left behind. And sooner or later, they were going to rise up, whether they did in Britain with Brexit or Marine Le Pen in France or what's going on in Austria now with having a recount. You know, if there's any kind of democracy and social media now and all of this, you just can't impose this kind of cost on the rest of the population. They're
not going to take it.
Right. That GDP issue on sustainable system, that's something you've written about a lot. Do you want to explain that a little more?
Yes. Well, it's just been a crusade of mine for such a long time, I kind of bore myself talking about it.
I'm sorry.
But basically, it's the old textbook model, which allows this creative accounting sleight of hand, which allows companies to, quote, externalize from their balance sheets any social or environmental costs their production imposes on anybody else. And that happens, too, at the national level when it's all added up into GDP. And so basically GDP is simply about money changing hands. And the externalities are only now beginning to be counted. I mean, there's this new study by the IMF that says that these external costs floating around, which that kind of accounting at the firm level and at the national level in national accounts, i.e. GDP, that the actual cost of that is about $5.3 trillion annually on a global basis.
Wow.
And so, and they account in the health effects and of pollution and all kinds of things, and so it was just a crazy model. And a few years ago, there was a group that did a study for the UN, which was equally shocking, saying that all of these profits that have been posted by all of the multinational corporations, basically, if they had to internalize these costs on their balance sheet, that it would pretty much wipe away all of their so-called profits.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how bad the scoring system is.
Wow.
So no wonder we have this political uprising. Now, the whole problem is, as you know, Ellen, that it's much easier to diagnose problems, you know, where Donald Trump and Bernie and, you know, can go around the country and say, yes, you know, it's to do with the trade, bad trade deals and this and this and this. But to actually prescribe for what to do about it, got to go much deeper. And you've got to throw away all of those old economic textbooks. You've got to retrain all of the finance professors at business schools that are teaching the wrong thing. And this is what a paradigm shift is. It's absolutely from top to bottom, you know? And that's why it's so scary and so difficult, because people look at their 401ks and see that they've got their nest egg all tied up with all of this old accounting, and so naturally they want to cling on. And the same with all the asset managers at pension funds, you know, everybody wants to cling on to the old accounting system because it's all they've ever known. Their identity and their livelihood is kind of tied up with it.
How do you mean their 401ks, though? I mean, what?
Well, because, you know, they're all invested in the same kind of way.
Oh, I see, that their companies they're invested in.
In the same companies, yeah. You know, that are externalizing their costs, and all these costs now are coming back to bite us.
Mm-hmm.
And so the loops are getting shorter and shorter. And in the pension fund world, as you know, the asset managers talk about universal owners. And most pension funds now are universal owners, meaning that they own pieces of all of the companies across the whole spectrum in every sector. So if you are a universal owner like that, it means that one company in your portfolio is dissing another company in your portfolio, imposing costs. They're all imposing costs on each other, as well as the public. And so the game is up, you know?
Right. And if we could if you think of all the money that's in pension funds and 401ks and so forth, if you could switch that money over to green investment, but it's not going to happen, it seems to me, unless you can get government involved and just set it up in a way that we have this great fund you can invest in, everybody would do it.
pieces of it are happening. And like, for example, the UN Principles of Responsible Investing that has been around for about 10 years and our company is a signatory member, they have as their members most of the pension funds in the world. And so they've got at the moment about $56 trillion in assets under management in the within their membership.
Wow.
And they've been pooping along kind of knowing that they were going to have to change the whole paradigm, but so deeply invested in the current paradigm, over-investing in fossil fuels, you know, and all these companies that are producing more costs and more pollution than they are actual useful product. And this is why we cover the Green Transition Scoreboard. We cover the private investments. Now our current number is $7.1 trillion. Worldwide is the cumulative amount of investing already in the green economies around the world. And, you know, we need to keep that up, about $1 trillion a year. And then it'll be unstoppable because then you've scaled solar and wind so that you've put fossil fuels out of business. We've already pretty much put nukes out of business. They're too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Wind power now is cheaper than almost any other form
of
electricity. So we know it's happening, you know, but there's still all the climate deniers in the Congress.
Well, you can't deny things like that the oceans are deteriorating. I mean, it does seem like we're at the point where we need everybody to wake up all of a sudden, but it's the nature of things like the Internet that could actually happen. In other
yes,
words,
it could actually
it could
happen
overnight.
Now.
People could suddenly...
Right. Just like blockchain could really reform finance much faster. And you know, Ellen, it reminds me really of evolutionary theory in biological terms, where evolution doesn't proceed along a nice, orderly kind of path. You have what's called step functions, where suddenly the system goes over a threshold into a completely new state. And what's happening to the global economy is exactly that the interactivity that we have now with social media and all of these globe-girdling technologies that we created and never thought about how to manage, they are now accelerating all of these globalization processes, you know, high-frequency trading, financialization, all this stuff that's going on. And so breakdowns drive breakthroughs. And what's happening now is that the whole financial system is going into a step function. The whole energy system, the fossil fuel energy system, is going into a step function where renewables simply are the evolutionary successor.
Yeah, that's actually very exciting. And that does bring us to Brexit, where you have a breakdown of the system. Do you want to comment on that a bit? I know you're born in the UK, so you probably have.
Yes, I mean, I was born in the city of Bristol in what's now Little England, not Great Britain.
Yeah.
So it is kind of a bit of a shock.
I have friends there who are, you know, quite opposed, even though, I mean, they're just like me, they're sort of liberal, you know, all into helping people and stuff. They're not big capitalists, but they're opposed to Brexit because they're quite afraid of the immediate short-term effects, you know, the housing market going down and loss of business.
Oh, yes. And, you know, just like we were saying, it's easy to prescribe. I mean, it's easy to diagnose problems. Okay, you know, the Brexit crowd could lay out all the problems with the EU. There was a lot of scapegoating of the bureaucracy at the EU, just the way the Republicans scapegoat Washington here. You know, that it's easy to blame somebody else, you know, or blame immigrants or all of that. And that doesn't get you to where you want to go because you don't have a deep enough analysis to make a sensible prescription. And the prescription has to be a completely new way of doing globalization. And it's not that I'm against globalization. I think that we are the human family, obviously, has been migrating all over the planet. And we are a global species, whether we admit it or not. and we are evolving. You know, we started off as roving bands of nomads, and then we settled in villages and towns and cities, and that's been the evolutionary progression, and we are at a whole different stage now, of course, with cities of 20 million people and all kinds of things like that we have no knowledge and no experience of dealing with. But the prescriptions for the kind of, how do we globalize minimum wages? How do we globalize environmental ethics? How do we globalize human rights? You know, that it's perfectly possible to create a form of globalization which doesn't simply maximize money income, which is what the prior globalization up to this point has really done.
Yeah.
So we just have to change the model. And that's what politicians can't seem to get their arms around.
Yeah, and that is the problem with we've got this fixed economic theory that is wrong, that there's a fixed amount of money out there that you have to pull it in taxes before you can spend it, and therefore all governments are broke because they all had to borrow when they couldn't meet their budgets with taxes.
Yeah.
So they can't do new programs. But in fact, we know that's not where money comes from. You don't have to pull it in before you spend it. You need to spend it first. That's
absolutely, yeah. And so there we're back to the whole paradigm shift.
Right.
You know, that, and I mean, I remember Thomas Kuhn, who was at the Princeton University with Einstein, and he wrote this book in the 60s called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions about how paradigm shifts occur in science. And what happens is the anomalies from the application of the old theory, the anomalies keep building up, and oh, you can't explain how this is, why is this happening, and why is this happening? And finally, the anomalies get to the point where everybody says, oh, okay, actually it's the model that's wrong. We have to redo the model.
Uh-huh.
And we're at that point now, and I can remember having Professor Kuhn at my dinner table one time when I lived in Princeton, and we were all sitting around the dinner table, and somebody asked him, well, Professor Kuhn, you know, when are we going to get this new paradigm? And this was, my God, we all were talking about this 20 years ago. And I remember he just leaned back in his chair and took a deep breath, and he said, well, one funeral at a time.
Yeah. Well, it is encouraging in a way, though, when you see that how much resistance we have to overcome. When you think, like when we founded the Public Banking Institute, we had 20 states that had bills of one sort or another for publicly owned banks, and none of them managed to get passed. And then you get kind of discouraged, and you think, well, it didn't happen. But when you realize how much resistance there is out there and how much misconception about how money works and the economy works and all that, it's just the slow drip theory. You just got to keep.
Yes, you've been educating all of the state treasurers and the state politicians. And
they just gradually wake up. And we get more and more politicians who contact us and want to, you know, they're interested, they want to do it, or people that are running for office that are interested. So.
God, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Well, I know it's very, very hard work. And yet we have the truth of the matter is that breakdowns drive breakthroughs. And we're having these multiple breakdowns in so many of our social systems and, of course, the environment. And that's what drives the breakthroughs. It opens it up. And if there's any good news in Brexit, it will be if it's taken, you know, as a learning experience. And also on the part of the EU, and I have been involved with all kinds of activities with the European Commission over the years. I've been in that building wandering around. You know, we were doing that conference back in 2007 called Beyond GDP. And that was an activity of the Commission, which was quite wonderful. You know, it educated all of the member countries about what was wrong with GDP and said, look, you know, we've got new models. You're not flying blind. If we change the model, we know how to do this. We've got the new statistics and all that, you know. And so, but I think what is happening at the EU level now is the realization, okay, you know, we do have to really communicate more with the general public, and we can't go on, you know, using this kind of model of global trade and all the rest of it. And so I think that everybody could take all of this as a learning experience, and we could in the U.S. too. Mm-hmm. Because, yes, we do have to redo trade. We can't do trade on the old GDP model that leaves most of the people out, and it's really most of these trade deals have been done at the behest of large corporations. And that's what people are upset about. So we do need to use these as learning experiences.
Right. So interesting. We could talk for another hour.
Yes, we could.
Getting close to the end of our time. So
yes.
I wondered if you wanted to give, like, your websites and how people can find your work.
Oh, yes. They can find me at Ethical Markets. That's plural, all one word, ethicalmarkets.com. And our TV shows are on demand anytime at ethicalmarkets.tv. And if people want to look at the Green Transition Scoreboard and know what companies to invest in to be part of the future, they can go to greentransitionscoreboard.com.
That's great. Well, it's been my pleasure talking to you.
Keep up your good work, Ellen. And also my thanks to the Public Banking Institute and all the incredible work you all are doing there.
Oh, and we thank you for your support, which has been great.
Well, it's really good work.
I've been speaking with Hazel Henderson, president of Ethical Markets Media, publisher of the Green Transition Scoreboard, and the author of 9 books, including Building a Win-Win World.
I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report. The word of the day is redlining. Redlining is the practice of denying services, either directly or through selectively raising prices, to residents of certain areas based on the racial or ethnic makeups of those areas. In this instance, the redlining we're referring to is in housing loans. Big private banks deny mortgages to people of color without regard to their income. In 2015, it was revealed that the banks were doing it in Baltimore. Now, a new report says the same for St. Louis, Milwaukee, and even Minneapolis. Last year, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, a group dedicated to increasing the flow of private capital into traditionally underserved communities, released a report demonstrating that banks' lending practices in the city of Baltimore were racially discriminatory in nature. The data suggested that far from merely denying home loans to people based on low income or bad credit, at least some of those denials were correlated only with race and no actual prohibitive lending factors. Lending was greater in neighborhoods with predominantly white ownership and lower in predominantly black-owned neighborhoods after all other factors were taken into account. That 2013 data that helped build the report was pretty devastating. 797 loans for Baltimore's 400,000 black residents and 2,000 loans for Baltimore's 175,000 white residents. Many banks also apparently believe that people of color living in a neighborhood might keep property values low, the best example of self-fulfilling prophecy I've seen in years. Because of this, there was a 16-point percentage gap in lending to higher-income borrowers between neighborhoods with minority populations of 10% and 80%, presumably reflecting a relatively steady rise in denials the more minority residents were there. So imagine our disgust here at the Public Banking Institute when a brand new report this week revealed the following. In the cities of St. Louis and Milwaukee, the racial composition of the neighborhood is a strong predictor of mortgage activity. Lending is greater in neighborhoods with larger white than African American populations. In the Milwaukee metropolitan statistical area, whites represent 70% of the population, but they received 81% of the loans. African Americans, who are 16% of the population there, only received 4% of the loans. And in the St. Louis metropolitan statistical area, While white residents are 75% of the population, they received 83% of the mortgage loans. And in contrast, African American residents are 18% of the population, but received only 4% of the loans. Things are a little better in Minneapolis, but the variable that best predicts home loan activity there is the median family income of the neighborhood, though the loan market favors white applicants slightly. Lending in low-income tracts in the city of Minneapolis was visibly lower, but some areas of moderate income saw extensive investment. Meanwhile, there's a large imbalance there in lending toward the exurban ring outside the Beltway. And finally, it is difficult, the report concluded, for qualified borrowers of any race to secure credit in high-poverty, hyper-segregated areas. The effects of redlining are devastating to minority communities. They also rip apart the basic fabric of cities as a whole. The Baltimore report released last year concluded the following. When home loans, small business credit, and community services are absent, as they are in much of Baltimore, the results are concentrated poverty, lack of opportunity, and growing frustration. The fact that redlining is still occurring in St. Louis is particularly disturbing. As Bryce Covert of ThinkProgress.org wrote 2 years ago, Ferguson, a small city adjacent to St. Louis, is a prime and egregious example of discriminatory housing policies and segregation. Out of 50 metro areas across the country, the St. Louis area where Ferguson is located is the ninth most segregated between whites and blacks. The city has been redlined, first completely legally, and later more surreptitiously, for about 100 years. Denying groups of people the opportunity to own homes is also denying them the opportunity to ensconce an interest in invested property. It's part of the reason why the overall wealth gap between whites and blacks is still so large. This gap, this deprivation, these deliberate inconsistencies all contextualize the unrest we've been seeing this summer between the police and the people. They feed into all kinds of violent mythologies, and they make it very clear the American dream is not being shared equally. Even more disturbing, and I think ultimately telling, is the fact that no amount of regulation of the private sector seems to have been able to stop or discourage redlining. It's still going on, after at least 100 years. It is, I would conclude, endemic to private banking. What I mean by that is, if we allow big private banks to determine social policies, which is exactly what we're doing when we give the private sector the power to decide who does and who doesn't get home loans, the private sector will reflect the racism of those in control of our economic system. That means redlining will always be a risk. And this is also where I respectfully part ways with the Community Reinvestment Coalition. That group, which has done a fantastic job documenting racism, seems to believe that we can shame some of the banks into stopping their racist practices and convince other people and financial institutions to invest in minority communities. Well, although private investment can sometimes play a role in righting social wrongs, most of these institutions have no incentive to do so. Their executives obviously don't care about racism, since they're making money perpetuating it. In contrast, as I've written before, public banking seeks to channel public investment under the theory that it's our money in the first place. The Bank of North Dakota, pursuant to legislative authorization in 2011, offers origination of conventional residential mortgage loans if private sector mortgage loan services are not readily available. And while it's true that BND utilizes private banks' mortgage criteria, a public bank in the city of Baltimore or St. Louis could focus its lending criteria with an eye towards correction of existing disparities. And in any event, the Bank of North Dakota helps community banks in the state, and community banks tend to have more flexible lending criteria than Wall Street banks. The transparency of public banks, which have no private shareholders, would eliminate racism in lending outright. So would the creation of public mortgage banks like those that exist in Germany. The seeming inevitability of redlining is one more argument why finance is better seen as a public utility than a private commodity. So let's keep working on creating public banks. In the meantime, see if your own bank or financial institution is complicit in redlining. And if they are, move your money out of there and tell them why you're doing so. Let's keep fighting for the right to do the right thing with our money. I'm Matt Stannard.
We're pleased to be joined now by David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, which has done landmark work in assessing and reporting on the impact that public banks can bring to local governments, as well as other publicly established institutions that help grow local economies within their respective borders. These institutions have reshaped and enriched the offerings and services and efficiencies of local economies by providing a public option, and in the process, they've enriched the Commonwealth by protecting common public interests and assets. ILSR has achieved impressive results in helping stem the tide, privatization of public assets.
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance has, since our inception, which was in 1974, been focused on what cities can do in terms of exercising the authority that they have to enable their citizens to have a ownership stake in their future and to generate a significant amount of their wealth, not entirely internal to their borders. We think of cities as nations, map the flow of resources through their borders, and they do enact laws that essentially try to maximize the good of the and the welfare of the people within their borders, and that's similar to the way we approach cities. We started an initiative about 3 or 4 years ago that is called the Public Good Initiative, which is somewhat broader. It primarily focuses on the issue of the public and the private. And the founding fathers, when they set up the Constitution and declared independence of Great Britain, they thought, John Adams talked about the positive passion for the public good should always supersede the private interests. And we have a rich history in this country of doing that. I mean, the first major public institution in the United States of America is in the Constitution, was part of the cabinet for 200 years, and it's called the Post Office. And the Post Office has a rich history, not only in delivering the mail, but in its very inception in 1792, Congress enacted subsidies such that the newspapers would be delivered free from city to city. And they did that because they wanted information to be broadly disseminated and they wanted to have an informed citizen, and it worked out astonishingly well. In fact, Alex de Tocqueville said it was an astounding thing for a Frenchman to see that in every small town in the United States at that time, there was a newspaper. And in the late 19th century, when the package delivery, parcel delivery firms were becoming an oligopoly and they were mistreating their consumers, the post office started a parcel post. And in the early 20th century, when the banks were mistreating their customers, they started the postal banking system. So this was an institution that was a public institution that saw itself broadly as trying to honor and maximize the public good. We created the national parks. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of libraries. We created a decentralized, publicly owned system of public education. And then in the 1930s, we, of course, expanded the concept of the public good to social insurance, like Social Security, and in the 1960s to health care, at least for the elderly. So we have a rich tradition, but in the last 30 years, and I mean literally from 1980 on, we have begun to subordinate the public to the private. And in 2016, the word government is now a pejorative. The word public is not that far behind, and the word private is sacred. And so, people now see privatization in virtually every aspect of American life, and it in fact has sort of colonized even our thinking. So people now think that government enterprises are inherently less efficient than private enterprises, and they see the government as being unresponsive, and so on and so forth. But and so in 2016, we created, I mean, in 2013, we created this initiative to specifically address the issue of the public and the private, and should try to reclaim the narrative and try to inform people that although everybody likes to complain about the government, it turns out that public institutions, whether it's a municipally owned utility company or a municipally owned water department, that it turns out that government can and does provide competitive and high-quality services and has traditionally done that.
It's a very challenging time because it seems that we're losing any real prospects of reclaiming control of these things as the corporate influence takes over at policy points. But what would you say the key steps would be for citizens to do relative to helping to restore and reverse this trend against public ownership in the commons?
Well, I think one thing that they can do is they can talk about it. Even among one's friends, if you talk about government or you talk about public enterprise, the immediate reaction will be, well, that doesn't work, or they can't do that, or that's corrupt, or that's inefficient, or you have civil servants who are lazy or overpaid. You will get that immediate reaction, and one needs to engage in that conversation. And if you engage in that conversation, you need to be informed. And there is a rich literature that will give you chapter and verse on the efficiencies of the public sector. But we're not only talking about public ownership, but we're also talking about the public option in the same way that the Nonpartisan League was talking about the public option. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance works with cities to encourage them, enable them, and help them to build their own telecommunications network, high-speed fiber-based telecommunications networks. And there are about 80 cities now that in the country that have citywide fiber networks, and many, many more have partial fiber networks to their schools or internal to the operations of cities. And in virtually every one of those cities, there are phone companies and cable companies that provide internet service and broadband service. And so it's a competitive environment. It's not a monopoly by the city, but every time that they establish one of those, the rates mysteriously go down precipitously. even if they ran at a loss, if you take into account the savings that people get from their cable bills or their phone bills, it way offsets any subsidy that might come from the taxpayers. And most of these don't have any subsidy whatsoever from the taxpayers. And so I think that the public option is important. And then the other is the exercise of authority over the private sector. We have gotten to the point right now where you have political parties that essentially are asking for the abolition of public authority. The Libertarian Party platform, if anybody is interested in reading it, and the platform would abolish the income tax, would open up our borders, by the way, not only to trade in goods, but people. They would allow for unlimited immigration into the country. Essentially, it's the disappearance of the ability of people to make rules that can protect and help to design their future. So I think that, there are a number of steps to be done, but it seems to me that the very first step is to reclaim the narrative, and the way to do that is for people to open their mouths and initially say, geez, I've been bombarded by my friends and I can't answer to their questions, and then to do a little research and open your mouths again.
That's David Morris, co-founder of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. We'll be hearing more of our discussion with him on coming editions of It's Our Money. And speaking of opening our mouths to help change the narrative, you may have heard something about a political convention getting underway in Philadelphia next week, when the Democrats take the stage, as the Republicans before them, to nominate a candidate for president. Well, this year's conventions are much more than that, of course, with wide-ranging stakeholder interests from around the country converging to make their respective points. One of the big ones is, of course, the issue of money in politics, that key driver that special interests use to create and shape the public policies that we all have to live with. So there will be demonstrations and protests, for which the people will take time and expense to get into the fray, or at least as close into the fray as they're allowed to go, to make their points. One of those people is a veteran monetary reformer, author, global monetary consultant, and the former executive director of the Public Banking Institute, Gwen Hall Smith, who intends to take a stand in Philadelphia. I've asked her to share her motivation with us.
Because I've followed it so closely, I've become more painfully aware than ever of how our democracy has essentially been stolen out from underneath us. And the way it's been stolen out from underneath us is much the same way as our economic agency has been stolen from us as well over time by the powerful vested interests in the banking system and Wall Street. And so it seemed to me that in this election, the connection between those economic interests and the threat to our democracy couldn't be more clear. So I'm joining with Democracy Spring, who is a relatively new group demanding the end to Citizens United, calling for public campaign finance and ensuring that all voters in this country have the ability to vote. You know, that was one of the saddest things, I think, about primary season, was how many places suppressed the voters by simply closing down polling stations in advance of the vote. Because I think they knew that if people came out en masse, which they did, that the election wouldn't go the way the establishment had planned. And I actually personally don't believe the election in fact went the way the establishment says it did, because of the huge amount of voter fraud and voter suppression that occurred. So I'm going down to stand up for that. And we can't ignore the links between the economic system that we've been working on changing and politics. It's not just a matter of changing the way money works in politics. It's the way we need to change the way money works in general. It's a problem. Part of the answer is to change the system so that it doesn't foster the kind of frustration and inequity, frankly. That's what it really boils down to, is that unlike the promise, one person, one vote, what we have is oligarchy now. I don't think there's any denying that, the wealthy people have a lot more say in what happens in our country than average people do. And everything is reliant on a democracy that works for people. You can't have any of that if democracy only works for the wealthy. Yeah. And that's unfortunately where we are right now. So if people are interested in joining Democracy Spring and standing up for these changes, which are, again, getting rid of Citizens United, a constitutional amendment to overturn the role of money in politics, public financing of elections, and a guaranteed vote for people that can vote, you know, an end to voter suppression, things like mandatory voter registration when you get your driver's license. You know, we have the technology. It isn't that hard to understand how people could vote more easily and more effectively in the future. And I think that it's high time that American democracy took those steps to make sure that happens. See, and I want to stand with them doing that.
That's Gwen Hall Smith of Vermonters for a New Economy and former PBI executive director, discussing her participation with the Democracy Spring demonstrations at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. For more information about those activities, visit democracyspring.org. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.